time for Author Meets the Critics. Welcome to the Author Meets the Critics, where today's guest is one of America's loved balladeers, Burl Ives. His book, just published, is called Wayfaring Stranger, and it's the target this afternoon for critics Louis Untermyer and James Michener. But before the author tangles with his critics, here's your regular chairman, John K. M. McCaffrey. Good afternoon, everyone. Many of you have seen Burl Ives in person. Most of you have heard his warm, nostalgic voice on the radio or on records in your own homes. Today, you'll meet a new Burl Ives, author of a new book, his autobiography, entitled Wayfaring Stranger. But before you meet Burl Ives, and he meets his critics, here's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Tales of the South Pacific, our good friend, James Michener.
I would like to get one thing straight right at the start. There is probably no one in America who excels me in my admiration for Burl Ives as a singer. But, as a writer, he leaves much to be desired. I think he and his book are open to five substantial criticisms. One, I have a feeling that much of the style of this book is phony. Two, many of the incidents, while amusing or excellent in themselves, have no meaning. They don't add up to anything. They are spiritually and intellectually flat. One reads the book without acquiring any goodness from it. I hate to shoot Aristotle at so fine a fellow as Burl Ives, but I get no purgation from this book. Why did the author bother? Three, I think much of the book is in questionable taste. Specifically, I am very tired of men who make public fun of old maids. I see nothing funny in the attempts of an old maid to get married. Meeting Mr. Ives in person this afternoon, I should consider it very strange if the average old maid didn't want to marry him. I think the whole passage on Aunt Minnie is in poor taste. For there is not enough in this book about the wonderful songs. When I finished reading the book, I felt a little bit cheated. Five, this last point may be a bit unfair to Mr. Ives, but I'm sure he's tough enough to say so if it is. I work a great deal with young men who may be America's future writers. They are real artists with words, our only hope for a growing literature. I feel angry that a man already famous and successful, a man who has made his mark on American culture, should use up the paper, ink, money, and editorial time on a book which didn't have to be written. It's a good book, yes, but what does it accomplish? In one good song, Burl Ives accomplishes twice as much. In an album of his marvelous records, he accomplishes 500 times as much. Yet in this unnecessary book, he uses up one more chance the good young writers have of getting published. I think that this time, the wayfaring stranger wandered off into the wrong field.
Thank you, Mr. Michener. And now meet the famous editor, lecturer, and poet, Mr. Louis Untermyer.
Let me say at the beginning that I differ completely and completely with Mr. Michener's false summary. I am all for Burl Ives' Wayfaring Stranger. It is called an autobiography, but it really is a book of stories. Many of these stories remind me of the early Sherwood Anderson, the man who wrote Winesburg, Ohio. They are graphic and sensitive, the language is simple, and implies far more than it says. Burl writes stories the way he sings them, unaffectedly, but affectingly. He is by turns playful and poignant. He uses the speech of the people and gives you the feeling of folk tales that are as old as love and hate. The book is obviously about Burl, and he emerges not only as a singer, but as a warm and very full-bodied personality. Too bad we haven't got television. A medieval troubadour who managed to get himself born in modern America. One thing more. This is not only Burl's book, but it is a book of people. Farmers in the Middle West, outcasts in hobo jungles, schoolteachers and bootleggers, city scholars and hillbillies. Burl has known them all, loved them all, and has kept them all alive in these pages. He weaves them together in a kind of a continuing ballad. In short, reading the book is, for me at least, as enjoyable as listening to Burl singing The Foggy, Foggy Dew and then going on to Venezuela, and then pick up the chords of Barbara Allen and Lolly Tootum and the Erie Canal. Burl never exhausts either his repertoire or his listeners. He always stops while you're asking for more. He does that in this book, too.
Now, before the critics have at each other and the walls here of the Johnny Victor Theater and the RCA Exhibition Hall really begin to expand and jump, I would like to give our listeners some idea of what the book Wayfaring Stranger is all about. It actually grew out of the stories Mr. Ives used to tell his wife about his youth in southern Illinois. And as a very small boy, Burl already loved to sing. His grandmother taught him his first songs, Barbary Ellen, Big Rock Candy Mountain, and the Blue Tail Fly. And soon, all the folks around were asking him to sing. He learned hymns, too. He used to sing them to help out Mr. Preacher. And once, he was so carried away that he got religion right in front of the congregation. Burl was a game kid, ready for a fight, ready for fun. He grew up carefree, happy-go-lucky, without apparent ambition. His father managed to send him to college, but Burl did not stay there long. One day, he slammed the door to the classroom, slung his guitar across his shoulder, and took to the road for good. He was setting out to find himself.
I'm just a poor, wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world of woe, and there's no sickness and no toil and trouble in that fair land to which I go.
Burl had hard years when he got to New York. He was often hungry, often lonely, and in and out of love. But he kept on singing whenever and wherever people would listen. One day he got his real chance on the radio with a coast-to-coast hookup over NBC. He opened his program with a theme song you have just been hearing. It became a best-selling record, a trademark for Burl Ives, and it's the ballad for which he named this book.
I'm going there to see my mother. I'm going there no more to roam. I'm just a going over Jordan. I'm just a going over home.
I hope you have some idea now of what Burl Ives' book, Wayfaring Stranger, is like. It's time to return to our critics. Mr. Michener, has your heart melted a little since you heard the author sing?
Oh, whenever I hear Mr. Ives sing, my heart melts considerably. I don't know of finer American songs than In the Streets of Laredo, which he sang in a movie that I saw, and, of course, Foggy, Foggy Dew. It's as a writer I'm talking about.
Oh, good. I was about to do anything to arrest any softening of the heart, Mr. Michener, but I see that all is still granite. Go ahead.
Yes, concerning style, for example, I want to read four passages which I think have the touch of contrivance about them and are mutually contradictory. There I heard a noise that became clearer and more distinct. A symphony of a million frogs played music and it fell upon my ear and it was pleasant. Now that is known in literature as playing the Bible theme. That is giving a few words of the fall of biblical quotation. It's good. It's a good trick. He came into the house and filled a large tub of water and bathed therein. Now, that has a phony ring to me, and bathed therein. I don't think Mr. Ives talks that way. I don't think fundamentally he should write that way. This Putnam will not expect, thought I. Now, I mean, it's inversion for effect, but how much better this style of writing is that creeps in when Mr. Ives is not on parade. As a matter of fact, her religion was of a different breed of cats than that of her husband, Cyrus White. She believed in sort of taking it easy and a-doing what was right and a-letting it go at that. Now, that's not in quotations. That's Ives talking as he feels. The other, I think, is phony, puffed up. And finally, this marvelous sentence. It just stopped me cold in my tracks. This was the Burl Ives of the records. Many, many months sped by. I sang lots of songs in lots of places for a great variety of chow. That's a marvelous sentence, right out of the feeling of the book. The rest of it, I think, is phony.
All right, now, Mr. Intermeyer, you've been very busily writing something down. Were you composing for the occasion?
I made a series of very aggressive notes, mostly against Mr. Michener. Not so much in favor of Burl, but as a refutation of Mr. Michener's technical those nasty cracks he just made. That thing about the Bible, this biblical language, this fine flow, this parallelism, said Mr. Mitchell, that's a good trick. Boyle could use it. It's what we know as the Bible cadence and fall. Well, it is a good trick, I'll admit that. But it was a good trick when Isaiah did it, too. And if Mr. Ives is any more culpable than the author of Lamentations... That wasn't Isaiah. Another man, but... Anyway,
Well, can we say that at least Mr. Michener's remarks were in the spirit of the Lamentations?
I should say so, but Jeremiah on a beautiful sunny Sunday afternoon is, I think a mean thing to do, because that particular form of cadence, that particular biblical language, I think was perfectly appropriate there, because Boyle was speaking from a background, a very biblical background, a background of good, earnest gospel people from which his early training sprang. And I think it is no more reprehensible of Ives to use that particular language than it is for the authors of the King James Version, including King James. But one other point that Mr. Mitchell made, which has been made very often, about authors. This is the way they write, in this curious semi-literary style. That isn't the way they talk. Well, of course it isn't. I doubt if Shakespeare talked in iambic pentameter. I doubt very much if Shakespeare delivered long monologues beginning to be or not to be.
But Mr. Untermyer, when a man writes an autobiography in that style, then I think he's putting on the dog. And it seems to me wrong for a man of Ives' marvelous vitality and quality to put on the dog. I don't like it.
I doubt when Mr. Michener writes Tales of the South Pacific, he puts on the dog. I mean, that particular colloquialism may be all right for this kind of a round table. But I think the difference between ordinary colloquial speech and the same man's writing when he is going to write at his best. I feel that when Boyle lets down, and I'm willing to admit that sometimes he does let down, it is not the Boyle Ives, the writer. Boyle Ives is in two or three capacities in this book, and sometimes he is a writer who writes, and that is not, to me, reprehensible.
Well, what do you say, Mr. Intermeyer, to the criticism which Mr. Michener advanced that so many of the stories and incidents which are recounted in the book simply come to nothing, that they seem to be dragged out of even the context of his life, dropped into the book, and that's all there is to it?
I'd say that this book, I speak now for a moment vaingloriously as an anthologist. This book is an anthology. It's an anthology of Burles' stories, reminiscences, business deals, how he almost got religion, how he almost got married, and how he finally did none of these things but became a great singer. And these reminiscences, these tales, are germane to the book. I think the stories are very appropriate.
Oh, now, that word germane is beyond me. I can't admit that. I'm thinking of, on page 151, The Dollhouse, a story of a remarkable speakeasy out west. It's thrown in, a character is portrayed, it comes to nothing. It doesn't add anything to my enjoyment of the story. It doesn't add anything to the meaning of Burl Ives' autobiography. It's just thrown in. I feel that many such things, the incident of the Capone gangster, is interesting, but it doesn't add up to anything. I'm no farther ahead when I'm through with that than when I started, I'm afraid.
Mr. Untermyer.
May I make the point that Mr. Michener, I think, is confusing an autobiography with a novel? An autobiography often doesn't come to anything. A life doesn't have a beautiful beginning, a middle, and an end. This is not an Aristotelian piece of art. A man's life very often is not. This is a group of things, reminiscences. He meets a guy who runs a speakeasy. He meets one of Capone's men. This is what happens to people in life. Has it a happy ending? Why, I think so. I'd say the happy ending is author gets publisher. That's always a happy ending.
In other words, you suspect that someone has been had. Mr. Untermyer? Well, I think that perhaps that isn't the right note, but whether it is or not, I think that
there
we
are. There is
to...
one incident. Now, let me make a difference there. I agree with some of the points you just made, that an autobiography is not a novel. But that marvelous section on pages 234 to 237, in which Burl Ives is telling how he out-slickered the city slickers at International House and slept on the roof up there while they were vainly trying to find him, seems to me awfully good. That does seem to me to add up to Burl Ives and to have a meaning and a warmth and a joy about it. It's the others that don't that I'm worried about.
Well, I wonder if our author is worried about it, and I think that we should hear from our balladeer, the author of Wayfaring Stranger, Mr. Burl Ives.
Mr. Michener, your first criticism, I believe, was the fact that in the book there were no songs and ballads. Well, this is not supposed to be a book of songs and ballads, and if you are interested in that particular literature, I can give you after the show a number of books, which does that very well. And since these people have spent their life collecting folk songs and folklore, they have done some very fine work, and if you're interested, well, I can give you those books. And I am not qualified as Mr. Lomax or Mr. Sandberg or Cecil Sharp to do such a job as they have done, and that was not the purpose of this book. Secondly, you said you didn't know why the book was written. You saw no reason for it. Well, actually, there wasn't a reason. Does there have to be a reason for a book being written? It just happened. Things came to pass so that I felt that I wanted to start writing, and so I wrote a book. No reason particularly, except that I had a lot of fun writing it, and I think that's reason enough. Now, your objections to style, I would like to explain how and why this thing that you object to in the beginning of the book, the biblical style, as you call it, that happened in the same way that I suppose a ballad or anything happens. I didn't sit down to write and make up a thing. When I started to work, it just sort of came out that way, and I left it that way.
Well, Mr. Michener, do you wish to make any further comment on that question of style?
He makes his oral words almost as persuasive as his songs and softens me up considerably, but I still think that there must be a reason for a book. I know too many fellas who may be the literary contributors to this nation's history who are beating their brains out trying to find a publisher for books. They won't sell as well as Mr. Ives because he's a famous man. He's a wonderful personality. Everybody knows him. And yet these books that may contribute to American life, and he admits that his was written with no burning desire, don't find a publisher, and I am a little bit sorry about that. I really am. I think a book must be written with a purpose. I think there's got to be a burning fire there to knock somebody over the head with it. And without it, I think we waste our paper and our ink.
Mr. Ives.
If a man works as long as I did on this book, and as you know, Mr. Michener, how long it takes to write a book, you can't say that it is not without some kind of burning something. Maybe it's not a desire, but something's cooking within a man who will sit down and write a book. Will you agree with that?
Yes, I will.
Thank you.
That's right.
Mr. Intermeyer.
Well, I would disagree with it. I'm sorry that Boyle did. I wanted to stop him in his tracks. He shouldn't admit anything. An author should never admit anything, especially to a publisher. And Mr. Michener is here as an editor and publisher this afternoon, rather than as an author. As an author, he is another character. He is Mr. Jekyll. He is here this afternoon as Mr. Hyde, that low slung. Lulz, I won't go into the. I won't characterize Mr. Michener more than necessary. But when he says that books all over America are being written with burning purposes, people, young men on fire, charring the edges of their notepaper in order to get it done with great heat and have
to
it published.
Write books.
Right?
Yes.
And they can't get it published. Isn't that too bad? Yes, Mr. Michener, it's too bad. But a burning purpose is not in itself a reason for publication. Oscar Wilde once said about a man who wrote such bad poetry, somebody said, but it's so sincere. He said, sincerity is no excuse. And I feel that way about a burning purpose. That isn't sufficient reason. The purpose, of course, in Burl's book, and Burl was too inarticulate to say so, is that he had accumulated a great many things, experiences, and he wanted to get them off his huge chest, and did. And this is Burl's saying to the world, now let me go on and sing, I've said these things, I've felt these things, here they are. You don't have to feel them, but I have.
Well, just to make everybody feel mad at everybody, Mr. Ives, what do you think of Mr. Untermeyer's characterization of you as an inarticulate person?
Well, I can't agree with him. I'm not. I'm hardly in Mr. Untermeyer's class when it comes to speaking. I think few people are, but I think that I can say what I have on my mind. So I'll have to go against my champion here.
Well, I think this is almost a case for the fire department. We're talking about who is on fire. I don't care whether the person who writes the book is on fire or not. Although I think if he is, it helps. What I want is the person who reads the book to be on fire after he reads the book. And I know hundreds of books that do that to me, and I'm disturbed that this one doesn't.
Well, I suppose if Mr. Ives wanted to sing, he could sing I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire at this point. Mr. Untermeyer.
Mr. Mitchell, I'd like to ask you now a very low personal question. As author and as editor, both of whom I've been at various times, does every book that you read and like set you on fire?
I'm going to answer that directly. If I were a publisher, I would love to have Mr. Ives' book on my list. Here's a book by a famous man. The cover on it is one of the finest covers I've ever seen on a book. It just makes you want to meet this man and to know him. And when you meet him and know him, he is as good as the cover on the book. It's a book that's going to sell widely. I think a lot of people are going to want this book because it is a good picture of a man who sings these wonderful songs. As a publisher, I'd love to have it. I'd fight to get it. I envy Whittlesey House that has it. And I wish we could get some as good. But as a writer, as a reader, then I come back to my old saying. This is, what shall I say, publicity writing. And publicity writing is all right. It helps sell records. It helps make a famous man more famous. But in the deep down pushing, burning qualities of a country's literature, it doesn't add up to anything. And there, as a writer, I must regret that.
Well, now, what about the question of bad taste, Mr. Ives? Mr. Michener has also accused you of bad taste throughout the book and in some incidents in particular.
Well, I think in regard to that, there's nothing I can say. He has a right to his opinion. But I just wonder, we will see. I think that he's wrong, and I think that there will be enough people who will be who read the book and say the other thing that it won't worry me very much, and I don't think it would worry me very much if it were really true, which I know it isn't, because what I've done here I did with a great deal of pleasure and a great deal of satisfaction, and the critics don't hail this as the great piece of literature of America, it's not going to disturb me very much because I enjoyed it. And I'll tell you something else. When it was published, I read it, and I enjoyed it again.
That's a real test.
Mr. Untermeyer.
On that point, Mr. McCaffrey and Mr. Michener, taste, either good or bad, is a highly personal thing. It admits of no definition, and it admits also of no argument. I did not find those passages in either bad or even questionable taste. I am, shall I say, a living, I think still living, American, and I'm afraid that Mr. Michener has spent so much of his time and thought in those South Pacific islands that he has lost the feeling of what our great Middle Western Americans would call good taste. Now, that is a remark in very bad taste, by the way.
Mr. Mitchell?
No, I can't agree with Mr. Untermeyer there. I think
as a matter of fact, you're a Midwesterner by origin.
I am a Midwesterner. I wasn't going to...
A Midwesterner with a hula skate?
Yeah.
That is something I would like to see.
You know, the way these men torpedo me, just as about as I'm about to make a point, is getting a little distressing here. Now, I think that when you use another person's frailty as a basis for a witty remark or something which shows you up as better than you are or were, I think that's in questionable taste. I think it's not questionable taste morally, In the sense one usually thinks of taste, but I think it's a questionable taste ethically. I don't like to see it done, and I don't like to see it done in a book, and I repeat this point very firmly. I do think that the passage about the old maid and parts of the passage about Juanita, the remarkable girl in New York, are in very questionable taste.
Well, one of the things that that impressed me about your book, Mr. Ives, was the fact that it actually didn't tell me very much about Burl Ives. For instance, we have the crucial scene where you walk out of the classroom. You're sitting there, and the professor is droning on at this teacher's college you're attending, and all of a sudden you get up and leave, slamming the door so hard that it breaks the glass, and you go out on the road. Now, that is a little bit like Saul of Tarsus being knocked off the donkey on the road to Damascus. I'm sure that you're going into singing ballads didn't happen just like that. As a matter of fact, I got very little background or reason why, psychological reason why, or reasonable reason why, that you did anything in the book. They seem to be all disconnected. Did you find that at all, Mr. Michener?
Yes. I, knowing Ives' records very well, looked in vain for the great earthy touch, which Mr. Unnemeyer says is here. I got it in three parts. The marvelous section on his grandmother I thought was first rate there. This old woman singing the songs that he came to love. In certain passages in which the songs were discussed, for example, his being arrested for singing Foggy Foggy Doo, one of my very favored songs that came through again, and in a very good short scene in which the professor of music throws him out when Ives wants to have taught personal music like guitar and so on, which the professor says, they don't use guitars in orchestras or something to that effect. There I got this marvelous feeling that I was looking for. In the other passages, I didn't. I never saw how Ives could sing these wonderful songs of America so well as he does. It doesn't come through to me in the book, unfortunately.
Mr. Ives?
I'd like to get back to this old maid proposition. I was acting there in the capacity of a reporter. I just told what happened, and to me it was an interesting thing. There was really no idea of poking fun at anybody. I reported an incident which, if it happened to be to you sad, well, that's just the way you would look at a thing like that. Some people, I think, would be amused by the story. In my own case, it was a case of reporting. That's where I happened to be on this trip that I was making, if you remember. And that's one of the incidents that I remembered. And
well, were you amused or were you sad at the incident, Mr. Ives?
At that incident, I was a little frightened.
That's good. I'll bet that's right, too. That's right. Yeah, well, now that's it. When that comes out in meeting you and listening to your songs, I get that great warmth that so many people feel about you, Mr. Ives. In the incident, that one tagline isn't there, that he was frightened. It happens, he goes on. And I think it's that lack of art that has me most disturbed about the book, as a book for people to read to get this picture of a man they all love so much.
Well, as far as...
Couldn't he be frightened in the next edition?
He could be. It would be a better story.
Yes, it probably would. I was interested in the jacket. When I looked at it, I thought, my, this looks just like Friar Tuck. And then now that I've looked at Mr. Ives, I realize that he looks like Friar Tuck, and that's a fine thing to look like. Well, I'm sorry, gentlemen. Time's up for everybody. And here's Bob Sherry to tell you what lies ahead on The Author Meets the Critics.
By next Sunday, we hope you've recovered sufficiently from the shock of the elections to participate in what we expect will be a knockdown, drag-em-out political fight over a new book by Representative Fred A. Hartley, Jr., co-author of the Taft-Hartley Act. And the book is called Our New National Labor Policy, and the subtitle was written on Election Day, Our New National Labor Policy, or Is It? Now that will be the theme of next week's Author Meets the Critics broadcast when Fred A. Hartley, Jr. meets his critics. We would like to call your attention also to our broadcast 2 weeks from today when Representative Saul Bloom, who takes over in January as chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House, defends his new autobiography. And now back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank you, Burl Ives, for coming here today to discuss The Wayfaring Stranger, and to thank you, James Michener and Louis Untermeyer, for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone, directed by Lee Jones, and came to you from the RCA Exhibition Hall in Radio City. This is Bob Sherry speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.